Hello and welcome to this new episode of the East-West Coffee Shop. I'm Julia Berghofer and today I will speak with two brilliant experts about Western sanctions towards Russia. What's next for US and EU sanctions and how well positioned is Moscow to cope with them? We will also speak about Germany and the disputed Nord Stream 2 project and why the government is pushing the pipeline forward despite the recent military buildup at the Ukrainian border and the Navalny case. We will hear about all this and more from two members of the Younger Generation Leaders Network, Agathe Demaret and Maria Chagina. Agathe is the Global Forecasting Director at the Economist Intelligence Unit. Prior to joining the EIU, Agathe worked as a Senior Policy Advisor for the French Treasury. She spent 5 years in Russia and 3 years in the Middle East, where she developed her knowledge of sanctions and policymaking. She's working on a book on the global ripple effects of US sanctions to be published by Columbia University Press in early 2022. Maria Chagina is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Eastern European Studies at the University of Zurich and a member of the Geneva International Sanctions Network at the Graduate Institute. She has been conducting research on the topics of international sanctions and energy politics in the post-Soviet states for the past 8 years. Now let's start with US sanctions. On April 15, the Biden administration has signed a new executive order imposing sanctions on Russia to respond to and deter, and I quote, the full scope of Russia's harmful foreign activities, end of quote. A number of Russian individuals and entities were targeted, and also 10 Russian diplomats were expelled from Washington. Agathe, you said recently in an interview with CNBC that the latest round of US sanctions was a mostly symbolic exercise. Why do you think that is the case?
Thanks so much for this question, Julia. I think it's a perfect one to start. So I think it's really a case of a disconnect between the media perception of the sanctions and the real effectiveness of the sanctions. As you've mentioned, the sanctions had two components. The first one was sanctions on targeted individuals, but it's highly probable that these Russian individuals do not have any assets in the US or any travel plans in the US. And the other part of the sanctions is targeting Russian sovereign debt. So in theory, this sounds very important, but in reality it is not, because Russia's sovereign debt is very low. It's falling. Essentially, Russia doesn't need to issue debt to pay for its budget. And also, the sanctions do not target what is called the secondary market. It gets a bit technical here, but what it means is that US investors can still buy Russian debt, not directly from Russia, but on the secondary market from other dealers, essentially. So it's really a case where a lot of people were expecting nuclear option sanctions, very tough sanctions, but for real, when we take a look at the details, they're not that, well, important for Russia.
Maria, do you agree that the nature of these sanctions laid out in the executive order are largely symbolic?
I do agree with Agathe that the first batch of sanctions under the new executive order was largely symbolic, simply because it defied market expectations. The expectations were much tougher, that the secondary market on sanctions on sovereign bond would be targeted, or old Russian bonds would be targeted. That didn't happen, and market expected much nuclear options, as Agathe mentioned. But I think it would be wrong to underestimate, you know, the framework that has been laid down by this new executive order, and it basically lays down a groundwork for deterrence. So there are few options within this executive order through avenues through which the US administration can tighten sanctions on Russia, including Russian sovereign debt, including on energy flows to Europe and Ukraine, and also on technology and defense companies.
So obviously, I completely agree with what you said, Maria. I think this is where we would diverge. Obviously, it's very difficult to, well, predict, forecast whether the US is going to impose more sanctions. The new sanctions have laid down a new framework, done some groundwork for more sanctions. My view, and I think this is where we would disagree, is that if the US was going to go for tougher sanctions, they would have done it with these sanctions in mid-April. But of course, it's impossible to know. So I suppose both of us are right, and only time will see what will happen.
Even when sanctions are mostly symbolic, they might still provoke a Russian answer, probably not in the economic and financial sector, but in terms of political moves and new aggressions. And again, I can imagine you want to comment on that.
Well, yes, it's also the question of whether sanctions backfire. And I think that's a very interesting topic. And actually, it goes back to the first question. I think that one of the reasons why the US remains cautious about imposing more sanctions against Russia is that US investors hold around $10 billion in Russian debt. So obviously, the US Treasury is quite concerned about this, and it's all about not shooting itself in the foot. When we take a look at the countermeasures that Russia is able to take, well, actually, it's very interesting because on the one hand, Russia is one of the largest oil and gas producers in the world, as we know. But on the other hand, its economic footprint is not that big. And actually, what we've seen is that the impact of sanctions over the past few years has been to prompt Russia to isolate itself from the US dollar, essentially, and Western financial channels, to lessen the impact of the sanctions. So I would say actually that the main countermeasure from Russia is really this isolation trend. It's all about, yes, insulating the Russian economy from the sanctions. And it will give Russia less leverage to actually reply to the sanctions. But at the same time, it also means that over time, US sanctions and Western sanctions in general against Russia are going to be less effective. And it's going to lead to more fragmentation of the geopolitical order, with on the one hand, Western countries, and on the other hand, what we could call non-aligned countries like Russia, China, Iran, that are getting closer to each other. And I think that's a very, very important trend, actually, that is taking place at the moment.
Would you say, and that's a question to the both of you, that Russia is in a good position to cope with the sanctions, and consequently, that sanctions don't have the desired effect from the perspective of the West in terms of punishing aggressions against Ukraine, human rights violations, cyber attacks, and disinformation campaigns?
Well, I think that there's been some university studies, some very good studies that have shown that in most cases, in the vast majority of cases, actually, sanctions do not yield results, at least not the intended results. And I think that in the case of Russia, it's pretty clear. Well, Crimea is no closer to going back into Ukrainian hands. The situation in the Donbass is still very tricky. I don't think that there is any hope for a rapprochement between the West and Russia at the moment. And actually, we could argue, and that's what most economists believe, we could argue that the recession that Russia went through in 2015, 2016, well, it was mostly due to the fall in oil prices that took place at the time. It wasn't really about sanctions. So to go back to your question, yes, I think actually Russia is pretty well placed to weather sanctions. It's actually diminishing its reliance on the US dollar. It has a very low debt. It's relying less and less on Western financial channels. So I think that over time, the entire Russian strategy is essentially to circumvent, to insulate the country, to make sure that US sanctions are going to become moot, pretty much.
I would disagree with this, simply because I think it's important not to see sanctions in a purely economic dimension and see if GDP goes down, that means sanctions achieved its effect. It's important to remember the goal of sanction and to link it to measure its effectiveness. Important to see what type of conditionality was put in place, how well-designed sanctions were in the first place, whether there were any loopholes, how third countries assisted a target state in trying to circumvent sanctions. And we have to say that not all of those components were in place for sanctions to work properly. So to answer your question, it's a fully loaded question, so I have to break it down. Whether Russia is well positioned to cope with sanctions, if we look at the latest US sanctions, we'll probably say yes. As Agat said, the impact on the Russian sovereign debt is moderate. That could be easily covered from the savings, ample savings that Russia gathered in its national wealth fund, so that is not a vulnerability point in no time. But at the same time, it's important to remember the sanctions are a long-term policy tool with cumulative effect. They gather in conjunctions with other factors, and we have COVID pandemic that will already shave off, depending on the scenarios, up to 1% of GDP, Russia's GDP in the future. We have also decarbonization trend that will reduce hydrocarbon revenues for the Russian budget. So cumulatively, all other factors will aggravate already adverse business climate in Russia. Also, Russia has been conducting its securitization of economic policy for the past 7 years or so, and that basically increased costs of this adaptation. So while Russia has shown that it can adapt to sanctions, also this adaptation doesn't come at no cost. There are costs in terms of shifting assets, for example, de-dollarization is estimated that it costs Russia about $7 billion. And there are also evidence that third countries did help Russia to, like China and India, did help Russia to substitute items that it couldn't source from the West. It also came at higher cost than Russia anticipated. Non-targeted countries that are not under sanctions also faced higher premiums on raising capitals in the West. So the effect of sanctions is much broader, and it costs Russia to cope with them. To answer the second part of your question, I think it would take, you know, maybe the whole podcast to to answer whether Western sanctions have a desired effect, because we would need to measure what the desired effect was in each case, whether it comes to human rights, Ukraine, or cyber attacks. I agree with Agat that coercion, behavioral change, takes place in about 10% of all sanctions regimes. That is something that rarely happens, especially in non-democratic targets. But again, sanctions is a long-term tool that the effects will accumulate over time. And there are also other functions of sanctions that are often discarded as something as symbolic, and it's sending a signal, something that has been done with the latest US sanctions, and also constraining the target state, sending signal to third states like China, who may be emboldened by inactivity of the West, and also deterring Russia as a target state to not to cross lines in the future.
I agree with you, Maria, when you say that sanctions come with a cost on Russia, and I think that's, well, we would agree on this, I think everybody would agree on this, but I think that seen from the perspective of Russian authorities, I think they would see it as an investment to make sanctions ineffective over the long term, price to pay in the short term, but then in the long term, it means that US sanctions would become ineffective. And actually, the other thing that I wanted to mention is you've mentioned that the cost of sanctions accumulates over time. But what we see in university studies is that when sanctions are effective, they are effective within 2 years of being imposed. Actually, there are very few cases where sanctions are effective over the long term, which actually raises the question of what to do with these sanctions, because it could send a signal to countries that they need to muddle through for a few years, and then the sanctions will be lifted simply because they're not very effective. And finally, yes, of course, sanctions have a symbolic purpose. Having worked on sanctions a lot myself with the French Treasury, I think that it's one of their main purposes, and it acts as a deterrent for the other countries. But when we take a look at what we see with Russia, I mean, it's pretty clear that the sanctions haven't had the desired effects on the Ukrainian crisis at the very least. So I think that so far they haven't really been a huge success.
Just to add on that, it is true that some research shows that sanctions are the most effective actually before they impose sanctions threats are the most effective. But the other side of research shows that if deterrence, if sanctions threat haven't been effective, that means that the other effect will come from a long term. The very recent research that has been done by American scholars showed that it takes up to 7 years for sanctions to be effective. Of course, it depends how the target reacts. It doesn't sit just and wait for sanctions. It's important how Russia also reacted to sanctions. But overall, the effect of sanctions is evident after 5+ years. And more importantly, the effect of sanctions lasts 7-8 years after they are lifted. So there is more evidence to how they work, not just in the first initial years.
Maria, an issue that might have puzzled a lot of people was that despite the announcement of President Biden to impose new sanctions on Russia, President Putin has participated in and delivered a speech during the climate summit hosted by the US a couple of weeks ago. How does that fit together?
I think it fits together well, again, in that phrase that Biden said that he wants a stable and predictable relationship. The US, similar to the EU, pursues a two-track policy that wants to push Russia back where it crossed the red lines. At the same time, the US would want to engage Russia in areas of cooperation, for example, in space or in the Arctic. Climate change, as you mentioned, is a big issue here. Also in the negotiations on Iran. So there is no intent to isolate Russia, and also it's impossible to isolate its economy, one of the most integrated in financial and trade systems. So there is no intent to isolate. The areas of cooperation are getting fewer and fewer, but there is still a way to cooperate with Russia and engage it. There are some discussions as to how it fits together, whether it's counterproductive to maintain this dialogue with Russia. And I think it depends on the areas which countries would want to pick. We can discuss Germany's support for Nord Stream 2 is one area of cooperation that it sees as a way to maintain the dialogue. But from the US point of view, to reach zero net goals, you would need to cooperate with Russia. So there is no counterproductivity. I don't see it here.
What I wanted to mention is that it's something that we see also in US relations with China, actually. Well, obviously, US-China relations are extremely tense at the moment. But what we see is that both the US and China leave the door open for some cooperation in the climate change area, essentially because I think everyone would agree that work needs to be done. So I think that this is very much in line with what we see is the US strategy of engagement, even with enemies at the moment.
Maria, you mentioned Nord Stream 2, and that brings us to Europe. EU sanctions are not only tricky because more stakeholders are involved when it comes to agreeing on united and strong measures, as decision makers like to put it. They are also complicated because we have actors like Germany around the table. In February, Germany, France, Poland, and the Baltic states joined forces to convince the EU partners to take steps against the Kremlin, including travel bans and asset freezes. Now, Germany has experienced a number of Russian aggressive activities on its soil, including a massive cyber attack on the Bundestag in 2015 and the assassination of a Georgian citizen in a Berlin park. And still, Foreign Minister Heiko Maas recently said in an interview that he opposes tougher sanctions and calls for more dialogue instead. How far do you think Berlin is ready to go to save Nord Stream 2?
Everyone wonders an answer to that question. And I guess it's important to see Germany's position, especial relationship with Russia in historical perspective, Germany's Ostpolitik or the new Eastern policy has endured despite the number of transgressions that you listed at the beginning of your question. Nevertheless, from Germany's point of view, energy cooperation is that last bridge that still needs to be maintained. One can question to what extent this clinging to the past fits the reality, whether Germany is still in the past, Wandel durch Handel, you know, change through rapprochement, still fits the reality and corresponds how Russia behaves. From Germany's perspective, energy cooperation is in a separate box. Berlin adamantly tries to compartmentalize issues, Nord Stream 2 in one box and all other transgressions in the other one. And it follows similar two-track diplomacy where it does maintain sanctions against Russia imposed in 2014. Germany has been a crucial EU member state to gather sanctions, sanctions coalition to maintain them, to prolong them. And we've seen that Germany has been a crucial partner for Ukraine to also prolong energy cooperation with the contract with Gazprom in 2020. So there is a lot that has been done from the Germany side. At the same time, Nord Stream 2 raises more questions the more red lines are crossed by Russia. And the first time that Nord Stream 2, the expediency of Nord Stream 2 was questioned was when Navalny was poisoned and was airlifted to Berlin. This is the only time where the German elites have questioned to what extent we can still have this business as usual with Russia. It has persevered with this position, supporting the pipeline as a purely economic project. Germany doesn't want to see the, you know, the geoeconomic impact that it would have on Ukraine. So currently, the state of affairs with Nord Stream 2 is subjected to the negotiations between US and Germany. There are some requirements where the US would be willing not to impose extraterritorial sanctions on Germany and on German entities or on Nord Stream 2 in general as a project. There has been some rumors that it could be a moratorium on the construction to discuss within the EU, also between the allies, how to proceed with that. But we have to say that the negotiations have been tedious. So far, there have been no clear indication that they would be resolved. The next challenge for Nord Stream 2 is, of course, Germany's election to Bundestag in September. So if we see Green Party entering government coalition, that would change the attitude in Berlin towards support for this very controversial project. And we know that the Green Party has even enshrined in its party memorandum that it would stop Nord Stream 2 if it becomes part of the government.
I think that Nord Stream 2 is actually a case in point of sanctions not really working. If we take a look at what you've said, Maria, essentially the only thing that could still derail the Nord Stream 2 project, which is about to be constructed, then the question is about insurance and certification of the pipeline, which is very tricky because of the threat of US sanctions. But I think that everybody agrees that the pipeline is going to be built. And I think that part of the explanation is actually that there is this extreme frustration across many European governments about US extraterritorial sanctions, which target a European project and European dealings. And I think that in my discussions with a number of people who follow the project quite closely, I think that this is an aspect of the equation that is not to be underestimated. That is to say that maybe Germany's stance towards Nord Stream 2 also has to do with the fact that Germany is trying to send a signal to the US that US secondary extraterritorial sanctions are actually an infringement on European sovereignty. And I think that's also part of the equation.
And going back, actually, it goes back to what we were discussing at the start of the podcast. Essentially, the only thing that could really derail the project is potentially that the Greens could enter a government in Germany, which actually clearly shows that US sanctions have been ineffective so far to stop the project. And maybe taking a broader look, what we can say is that they've probably put a strain on US-EU relations at a time when the US and the EU absolutely need to cooperate on Russia, on China, on other topics. So one could question actually whether imposing such harsh sanctions, threatening to impose sanctions on workers of German ports, for instance, was the best thing to do and whether it has backfired.
Despite of other Russian malign activities, it is Navalny who has become a symbolic figure for the Kremlin's ruthless behavior, and thus he was sort of at the center of the sanctions debate, at least for a long period of time. Now, Navalny has recently ended his hunger strike, his network is being disbanded by Russian authorities, and he didn't make headlines in recent time. However, what do you think? Will it make a difference for future US or EU sanctions? Should Navalny be back in the headlines for whatsoever reasons? For example, let's put it this way, should something tragic happen to him?
That's a million-dollar question. We don't know. To be completely honest, we don't know. I think it's very difficult to make any projections about this. I think that if we take the stance from Moscow, if we take a look at things from Moscow, I think that Moscow has seen that so far there haven't been any real retaliation from the US and the EU. I mean, meaningful measures against Russia because of the situation with Alexei Navalny. So I think that from Russia's point of view, this is a domestic issue. And what I think Russia expects is that if something from the US and the EU was to have happened, it would have already happened by now. So I don't know. I think nobody knows. I'll be very, very curious to hear what Maria says. I think that overall Moscow is going to tread a very careful line with Navalny. But at the same time, I think that Moscow knows that the US and the EU have very few options to impose more sanctions against Russia if they do not want to shoot themselves in the foot. I think that from the EU's perspective, well, Russia is, well, it actually supplies more than a third of Europe's oil and gas supply. So obviously that is very significant. I think that seen from the US, this is the debate that we had earlier. I think that the US has very few options to do more against Russia. So I think that Russia is going to tread a cautious line, but at the same time it knows that the West has very few options to retaliate.
Right, so for now we know that the US and the EU have spoken out against sanctions with regard to Navalny. The strategy is that both Washington and Berlin see sanctions as counterproductive in this case. So the strategy is to find ways through more liberal representatives within the Russian government, for example, Alexei Kudrin was mentioned in the media, to reach out and to talk about, through quiet diplomacy, to talk about Navalny. That could work, and if it doesn't work, there are still sanctions. And I would probably disagree here with Agat that there are many more sanction options before we even reach nuclear options, such as excluding Russia from SWIFT. It also depends which sanctions we're talking about, either from EU side or the US side. But even if we talk about oil and gas, it is also Russia depends on the exports, so it does need revenues from this. So the dependence is mutual. It's not to say that only the EU needs Russian gas. But aside from that, there are still a long list of options. If we compare it with Iran sanctions and Russia sanctions, they pale in comparison with what sanctions have been imposed on Russia. There are options to place state-owned banks, such as VTB, on the SDN list to impose sanctions on now burgeoning LNG sector, shipping companies and mining companies, and this is just to name a few of those. But you talked about what happens if something tragic happens to Navalny, and I think it's indeed hard to predict also, because I think we would need to think about the West potential options in light of a broader context. That might mean how Russia behaves towards Ukraine or potential cyber attacks in the US. And perhaps at this point, we would see some culmination, some trigger impact that would lead to stronger sectoral sanctions, for example.
I think actually, coming back to the point that you made, Maria, about mutual dependence, the dependence is absolutely mutual. And I remember from my years at the French Treasury when I was working on Russia sanctions and Iran sanctions, it was all about not shooting itself in the foot. And actually, that's the reason why we can't really imagine that the EU would and the US would go for sanctions against Russia that are as stringent as the ones that were imposed against Iran, because Iran is a minor player on the global economic scene. I think it's about among the 30 largest economies in the world, whereas Russia is much bigger, a big oil and gas exporter. And I think that this completely changes the mindset of policymakers when they need to deal with Russia. It's not dealing with Cuba with an embargo. It's not about dealing with North Korea, for instance, or even Iran. I think, well, the economic interests are such that policymakers need to take into account the interests of companies and investors. So obviously there is the symbolic aspect of sanctions, but there's also very critical jobs that can be at stake in some European countries and America potentially. So that's something that policymakers need to balance, and it's very, very difficult. But I think that overall, this makes very stringent sanctions against Russia unlikely.
Thank you so much, Agathe Demaret and Maria Shagina. This was the East West Coffee Shop, brought to you by the Younger Generation Leaders Network. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to learn more about the YGLN, you can visit our website www.europeanleadershipnetwork.org and follow us on Twitter at YGLNTweets. ¶¶